Chapter 27. Johnny came up wooden steps that had been shoveled clear of snow and salted down. He went through a set of double doors and into a foyer plastered with specimen ballots and notices of a special town meeting to be held here in Jackson on the 3rd of February. There was also a notice of Greg Stilson's impending visit, and a picture of the man who himself, hard hat cocked back on his head, grinning that hard, slantwise, "We're wise to him, ain't we, pard?" grin. Set a little to the right of the green door leading into the meeting hall itself was a sign that Johnny hadn't expected, and he pondered it in silence for several seconds, his breath pluming white from his lips. "Driver examinations today," this sign read. It was set on a wooden easel. "Have papers ready." He opened the door, went into the stuporous glow of heat thrown by a big wood stove, and there sat a cop at a desk. The cop was wearing a ski parka unzipped. There were papers scattered across his desk, and there was also a gadget for examining visual acuity. The cop looked up at Johnny, and he felt a sinking sensation in his gut. "Can I help you, sir?" Johnny fingered the camera slung around his neck.
"Well, I wondered if it would be all right to look around a little bit," he said. "I'm on assignment from Yankee Magazine. We're doing a spread on town hall architecture in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Taking a lot of pictures, you know."
"Go right to it," the cop said. "My wife reads Yankee all the time. Puts me to sleep."
Johnny smiled. "New England architecture has a tendency toward, well, starkness."
"Starkness," the cop repeated doubtfully, and then let it go. "Next, please."
A young man approached the desk the cop was sitting behind. He handed an examination sheet to the cop, who took it and said,
"Look into the viewer, please, and identify the traffic signs and signals which I will show you."
The young man peered into the viewing machine. The cop put an answer key over the young man's exam sheet. Johnny moved down the center aisle of the Jackson Town Hall and clicked a picture of the rostrum at the front. "Stop sign," the young man said from behind him. "The next one's a yield sign, and the next one is a traffic information sign. No right turn, no left turn, like that." He hadn't expected a cop in the town hall. He hadn't even bothered to buy film for the camera he was using as a prop. But now it was too late to back out anyway. This was Friday, and Stilson would be here tomorrow if things went the way they were supposed to go. He would be answering questions and listening to suggestions from the good people of Jackson. There would be a fair-sized entourage with him, a couple of aides, a couple of advisers, and several others, young men in sober suits and sports jackets who had been wearing jeans and riding motorcycles not so long ago. Greg Stilson was still a firm believer in guards for the body. At the Trimble rally, they had been carrying sawed-off pool cues. Did they carry guns now? Would it be so difficult for a U.S. representative to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon? Johnny didn't think so. He could count on one good chance only. He would have to make the most of it. So it was important to look the place over, to try and decide if he could take Stilson in here, or if it would be better to wait in the parking lot with the window rolled down and the rifle on his lap. So he had come, and here he was, casing the joint while a state cop gave driver permit exams not 30 feet away. There was a bulletin board on his left, and Johnny snapped his unloaded camera at it. Why, in God's name, hadn't he taken another 2 minutes and bought himself a roll of film? The board was covered with chatty small-town intelligence concerning baked bean suppers, an upcoming high school play, dog licensing information, and, of course, more on Greg. A file card said that Jackson's first selectman was looking for someone who could take shorthand, and Johnny studied this as though it were of great interest to him while his mind moved into high gear. Of course, if Jackson looked impossible, or even chancy, he could wait until next week, where Stilson would be doing the whole thing all over again in the town of Upson, or the week after in Trimble, or the week after that, or never. It should be this week. It ought to be tomorrow. He snapped the big wood stove in the corner and then glanced upward. There was a balcony up there. No, not precisely a balcony. More like a gallery with a waist-high railing and wide, white-painted slats with small decorative diamonds and curlicues cut into the wood. It would be very possible for a man to crouch behind that railing and look through one of those doodads.
At the right moment, he could just stand up and... "What kind of camera is that?"
Johnny looked around, sure it was the cop. The cop would ask to see his filmless camera, and then he would want to see some ID, and then it would be all over.
But it wasn't the cop. It was the young man who had been taking his driver's permit test. He was about 22, with long hair and pleasant, frank eyes. He was wearing a suede coat and faded jeans.
"A Nikon," Johnny said.
"Good camera, man. I'm a real camera nut. How long have you been working for Yankee?"
"Well, I'm a freelance," Johnny said. "I do stuff for them, sometimes for Country Journal, sometimes for Down East, you know."
"Nothing national, like People or Life?"
"No, at least not yet."
"What f-stop do you use in here?"
"What in hell is an f-stop?"
Johnny shrugged.
"I play it mostly by ear."
"By eye, you mean," the young man said, smiling.
"That's right, by eye. Get lost, kid, please get lost."
"I'm interested in freelancing myself," the young man said and grinned. "My big dream is to take a picture someday like the flag raising at Iwo Jima."
"I heard that was staged," Johnny said.
"Well, maybe, maybe. But it's a classic. Or how about the first picture of a UFO coming in for a landing? I'd sure like that. Anyway, I've got a portfolio of stuff I've taken around here. Who's your contact at Yankee?"
Johnny was sweating now.
"Actually, they contacted me on this one," he said. "It was,
Mr. Clausen, you can come over now," the cop said, sounding impatient. "I'd like to go over these answers with you."
"Whoops, his master's voice," Clausen said. "See you later, man."
He hurried off, and Johnny let out his breath in a silent, whispering sigh. It was time to get out, and quickly. He snapped another two or three pictures, just so it wouldn't look like a complete route, but he was barely aware of what he was looking at through the viewfinder. Then he left. The young man in the suede jacket, Clausen, had forgotten all about him. He had apparently flunked the written part of his exam. He was arguing strenuously with the cop, who was only shaking his head. Johnny paused for a moment in the town hall's entryway. To his left was a cloakroom. To his right was a closed door. He tried it and found it unlocked. A narrow flight of stairs led upward into dimness. The actual offices would be up there, of course, and the gallery. He was staying at the Jackson House, a pleasant little hotel on the main drag. It had been carefully renovated, and the renovations had probably cost a lot of money, but the place would pay for itself, the owners must have reckoned, because of the new Jackson Mountain Ski Resort. Only the resort had gone bust, and now the pleasant little hotel was barely hanging on. The night clerk was dozing over a cup of coffee when Johnny went out at 4 o'clock on Saturday morning, the attaché case in his left hand. He had slept little last night, slipping into a short, light doze after midnight. He had dreamed. It was 1970 again. It was carnival time. He and Sarah stood in front of the Wheel of Fortune, and again he had that feeling of crazy, enormous power. In his nostrils he could smell burning rubber.
"Come on," a voice said softly behind him. "I love to watch this guy take a beating."
He turned, and it was Frank Dodd, dressed in his black vinyl raincoat, his throat slit from ear to ear in a wide red grin, his eyes sparkling with dead vivaciousness. He turned back to the booth, scared. But now the pitchman was Greg Stilson, grinning knowingly at him, his yellow hard hat tipped cockily back on his skull. "Hey, hey, hey," Stilson chanted, his voice deep and resonant and ominous. "Lay 'em down where you want 'em down, fella. What do you say? Want to shoot the moon?" Yes, he wanted to shoot the moon. But as Stilson set the wheel in motion, he saw that the entire outer circle had turned green. Every number was 00. Every number was a house number. He had jerked awake and spent the rest of the night looking out the frost-rimmed window into darkness. The headache he'd had ever since arriving in Jackson the day before was gone, leaving him feeling weak but composed. He sat with his hands in his lap. He didn't think about Greg Stilson. He thought about the past. He thought about his mother putting a Band-Aid on a scraped knee. He thought about the time the dog had torn off the back of Grandma Nellie's absurd sundress, and how he had laughed, and how Vera had swatted him one and cut his forehead with the stone of her engagement ring.
He thought about his father showing him how to bait a fishing hook and saying, "It doesn't hurt the worms, Johnny. At least I don't think it does." He thought about his father giving him a pocket knife for Christmas when he was 7 and saying very seriously, "I'm trusting you, Johnny." All those memories had come back in a flood. Now he stepped off into the deep cold of the morning, his shoes squeaking on the path shoveled through the snow. His breath plumed out in front of him. The moon was down, but the stars were sprawled across the black sky in idiot's profusion. God's jewel box, Vera always called it. You're looking into God's jewel box, Johnny. He walked down Main Street, and he stopped in front of the tiny Jackson post office and fumbled the letters out of his coat pocket. Letters to his father, to Sarah, to Sam Weitzak, to Bannerman. He set the attaché case down between his feet, opened the mailbox that stood in front of the neat little brick building, and after one brief moment of hesitation, dropped them in. He could hear them drop down inside. Surely the first letters mailed in Jackson this new day, and the sound gave him a queer sense of finality. The letters were mailed. There was no stopping now. He picked up the case again and walked on. The only sound was the squeak of his shoes on the snow. The big thermometer over the door of the Granite State Savings Bank stood at 3 degrees, and the air had that feeling of total silent inertia that belongs exclusively to cold New Hampshire mornings. Nothing moved. The roadway was empty. The windshields of the parked cars were blinded with cataracts of frost. Dark windows, drawn shades. To Johnny it all seemed somehow dreadful, and at the same time, holy. He fought the feeling. This was no holy business he was on. He crossed Jasper Street, and there was the town hall, standing white and austerely elegant behind its plowed banks of twinkling snow.
"What you gonna do if the front door's locked, smart guy?"
Well, he would find a way to cross that bridge if he had to. Johnny looked around, but there was no one to see him. If this had been the president coming for one of his famous town meetings, everything would have been different, of course. The place would have been blocked off since the night before, and men would be stationed inside already. But this was only a U.S. representative, one of over 400, no big deal. No big deal yet. Johnny went up the steps and tried the door. The knob turned easily, and he stepped into the cold entryway and pulled the door shut behind him. Now the headache was coming back, pulsing along with the steady, thick beat of his heart. He set his case down and massaged his temples with his gloved fingers. There was a sudden low scream. The coat closet door was opening, very slowly, and then something white was falling out of the shadows toward him. Johnny barely held back a cry. For one moment, he thought it was a body falling out of the closet like something from a spook movie. But it was only a heavy cardboard sign that read, "Please have papers in order before appearing for examination." He set it back in place and then turned to the doorway giving upon the stairs. This door was now locked. He leaned down to get a better look at it in the dim white glow of the streetlight that filtered in the one window. It was a spring lock, and he thought he might be able to open it with a coat hanger. He found one in the coat closet and hooked the neck of it into the crack between the door and the jamb. He worked it down to the lock and began to fumble around. His head was thudding fiercely now. At last he heard the bolt snap back as the wire caught it. He pulled the door open. He picked up his attaché case and went through, still holding the coat hanger. He pulled the door close behind him and heard it lock again. He went up the narrow stairs, which creaked and groaned under his weight. At the top of the stairs, there was a short hallway with several doors on either side. He walked down the hall, past town manager and town selectmen, past tax assessor and men's, and overseer of the poor and ladies. There was an unmarked door at the end. It was unlocked, and he came out onto the gallery above the rear of the meeting hall, which was spread out below him in a crazy quilt of shadows. He closed the door behind him and shivered a little at the soft stir of echoes in the empty hall. His footfalls also echoed back as he walked to the right along the rear gallery, then turned left. Now he was walking along the right-hand side of the hall, about 25 feet above the floor. He stopped at a point above the wood stove and directly across from the podium where Stilson would be standing in about 5.5 hours. He sat down cross-legged and rested for a while. Tried to get a control of the headache with some deep breathing. The wood stove wasn't operating, and he felt the cold settling steadily against him, and then into him. Previews of the winding shroud. When he had begun to feel a little better, he thumbed the catches on the attaché case. The double click echoed back as his footfalls had done, and this time it was a sound of cocking pistols. Western justice, he thought, for no reason at all. That was what the prosecutor had said when the jury found Claudine Langer guilty of shooting her lover. She's found out what Western justice means. Johnny looked down into the case and rubbed his eyes. His vision doubled briefly, and then things came together again. He was getting an impression from the very wood he was sitting on. A very old impression. If it had been a photograph, it would have been sepia-toned. Men standing here and smoking cigars, talking and laughing and waiting for town meeting to begin. Had it been 1920? 1902? There was something ghostly about it that made him feel uneasy. One of them had been talking about the price of whiskey and cleaning his nose with a silver toothpick and 2 years before he had poisoned his wife. Johnny shivered. Whatever the impression was, it didn't matter. It was an impression of a man who was long dead now. The rifle gleamed up at him. When men do it in wartime, they give them medals, he thought. He began to assemble the rifle. Each click echoed back just once, solemnly, the sound of a cocking pistol. He loaded the Remington with 5 bullets. He placed it across his knees and waited. Dawn came slowly. Johnny dozed a little, but he was too cold now to do more than doze. Thin, sketchy dreams haunted what sleep he did get. He came fully awake at a little past 7. The door below was thrown open with a crash, and he had to bite his tongue to keep from crying out, "Who's there?" It was the custodian. Johnny put his eye to one of the diamond shapes cut into the balustrade and saw a burly man who was bundled up in a thick navy peacoat. He was coming up the center aisle with an armload of firewood. He was humming Red River Valley. He dropped the armload of wood into the wood box with a crash and then disappeared below Johnny. A second later, he heard the thin screeing noise of the stove's firebox door being swung open. Johnny suddenly thought of the plume of vapor he was producing every time he exhaled. Suppose the custodian looked up. Would he be able to see that? He tried to slow the rate of his breathing, but that made his headache worse, and his vision doubled alarmingly. Now there was the crackle of paper being crumpled, then the scratch of a match, a faint whiff of sulfur in the cold air. The custodian went on humming Red River Valley, and then broke into loud and tuneless song. From this valley they say you're going. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile. Now a different crackling sound. Fire. That's got it, you sucker, the custodian said from directly below Johnny. And then there was the sound of the firebox door being slammed shut again. Johnny pressed both hands over his mouth like a bandage, suddenly afflicted with suicidal amusement. He saw himself rising up from the floor of the gallery, as thin and white as any self-respecting ghost. He saw himself spreading his arms like wings and his fingers like talons and calling down in hollow tones, "That's got you, you sucker!" He held the laughter behind his hands. His head throbbed like a tomato full of hot, expanding blood. His vision jittered and blurred crazily. Suddenly he wanted very badly to move away from the impression of the man who had been cleaning his nose with the silver toothpick, but he didn't dare make a sound. Dear Jesus, what if he had to sneeze? Suddenly, with no warning, a terrible wavering shriek filled the hall, drilling into Johnny's ears like thin silver nails, climbing, making his head vibrate. He opened his mouth to scream. It cut off. Oh, you whore, the custodian said conversationally. Johnny looked through the diamond and saw the custodian standing behind the podium and fiddling with a microphone. The mic cord snaked down to a small portable amp. The custodian went down the few steps from the podium to the floor and pulled the amplifier farther from the mic, then fooled with the dials on top of it. He went back to the mic and turned it on again. There was another feedback whine, this one lower and then tapering away entirely. Johnny pressed his hands tight against his forehead and rubbed them back and forth. The custodian tapped on the mic with his thumb, and the sound filled the big, empty room. It sounded like a fist knocking on a coffin lid. Then his voice, still tuneless but now amplified to the point of monstrosity, a giant's voice bludgeoning into Johnny's head, "From this valley they say you are going." "Stop it," Johnny wanted to scream. "Oh, please stop it. I'm going crazy. Can't you stop it?" The singing ended with a loud, amplified snap, and the custodian said in his own voice, "That's got you, whore." He walked out of Johnny's line of sight again. There was a sound of tearing paper and the low, popping sounds of twine being snapped. Then the custodian reappeared, whistling and holding a large stack of booklets. He began to place them at close intervals along the benches. When he had finished that chore, the custodian buttoned his coat and left the hall. The door slammed hollowly shut behind him. Johnny looked at his watch. It was 7:45. The town hall was warming up a little. He sat and waited. The headache was still very bad, but oddly enough, it was easier to bear than it had ever been before. All he had to do was tell himself that he wouldn't have to bear it for long. The door slammed open again promptly at 9 o'clock, startling him out of a catnap. His hands clamped tightly over the rifle and then relaxed. He put his eye to the diamond-shaped peephole. 4 men this time. One of them was the custodian, the collar of his peacoat turned up against his neck. The other 3 were wearing topcoats with suits underneath. Johnny felt his heartbeat quicken. One of them was Sonny Elliman. His hair was cut short now and handsomely styled, but the brilliant green eyes had not changed. "Everything set?" he asked. "Check for yourself," the custodian said. "Don't be offended, Dad," one of the others replied. They were moving to the front of the hall. One of them clicked the amplifier on and then clicked it off again, satisfied. "People around these parts act like he was the bloody emperor," the custodian grumbled. He is," the 3rd man said. Johnny thought he also recognized this fellow from the Trimble rally. "Haven't you got wise to that yet, Pop?" "Have you been upstairs?" Elliman asked the custodian, and Johnny went cold. "Stairway door's locked," the custodian answered. "Same as always. I gave her a shake." Johnny silently gave thanks for the spring lock on the door. "Ought to check it out," Elliman said. The custodian uttered an exasperated laugh. "I don't know about you guys," he said. "Who are you expecting, the Phantom of the Opera?" "Come on, Sonny," the fellow Johnny thought he recognized said. "There's nobody up there. We just got time for a coffee if we shag ass down to that restaurant on the corner." "That's not coffee," Sonny said. "Fucking mud is all that is. Just run upstairs first and make sure no one's there, Moochie. We go by the book." Johnny licked his lips and clutched the gun. He looked up and down the narrow gallery. To his right, it ended in a blank wall. To his left, it went back to the suite of offices. And either way, it made no difference. If he moved, they would hear him. This empty, the town hall served as a natural amplifier. He was stuck. There were footfalls down below. Then the sound of the door between the hall and the entryway being opened and closed. Johnny waited, frozen and helpless. Just below him, the custodian and the other 2 were talking, but he heard nothing they said. His head had turned on his neck like some slow engine, and he stared down the length of the gallery, waiting for the fellow Sonny Elliman had called Moochie to appear at the end of it. His bored expression would suddenly turn to shock and incredulity. His mouth would open. "Hey, Sonny, there's a guy up here." Now he could hear the muffled sound of Moochie climbing the stairs. He tried to think of something, anything, Nothing came. They were going to discover him. It was less than a minute away now, and he didn't have any idea of how to stop it from happening. No matter what he did, his one chance was on the verge of being blown. Doors began to open and close, the sound of each drawing closer and less muffled. A drop of sweat spilled from Johnny's forehead and darkened the leg of his jeans. He could remember each door he had come past on his way here. Mucci had checked town manager and town selectman and tax assessor. Now he was opening the door of men's. Now he was glancing through the office that belonged to the overseer of the poor. Now the ladies' room. The next door would be the one leading to the galleries. It opened. There was the sound of two footfalls as Mucci approached the railing of the short gallery that ran along the back of the hall.
"Okay, Sonny, you satisfied? Everything look good?" "Looks like a fucking dump," Mucci responded, and there was a burst of laughter from below. "Well, come on down and let's go for coffee," the third man said.
And incredibly, that was it. The door slammed to. The footsteps retreated back down the hall, and then down the steps to the first floor. Johnny went limp, and for a moment everything swam away from him into shades of gray. The slam of the entryway door as they went out for their coffee brought him partially out of it. Below, the custodian presented his judgment.
"Bunch of whores."
Then he left, too, and for the next 20 minutes or so, there was only Johnny. Around 9:30 a.m., the people of Jackson began to file into their town hall. The first to appear was a trio of old ladies dressed in formal black, chattering together like magpies. Johnny watched them pick seats close to the stove, almost entirely out of the field of his vision, and pick up the booklets that had been left on the seats. The booklets appeared to be filled with glossy pictures of Greg Stilson.
"I just love that man," one of the three said. "I've gotten his autograph 3 times, and I'll get it again today, I'll be bound."
That was all the talk there was about Greg Stilson. The ladies went on to discuss the impending Old Home Sunday at the Methodist Church. Johnny, almost directly over the stove, went from very cold to very hot. He had taken advantage of the slack tide between the departure of Stilson's security people and the arrival of the first townsfolk, using it to shed both his jacket and his outer shirt. He kept wiping sweat from his face with a handkerchief, and the linen was streaked with blood as well as sweat. His bad eye was kicking up again, and his vision was constantly blurred and reddish. The door below opened. There was the hearty tromp, tromp, tromp of men stamping snow from their packs, and then 4 men in checked woolen jackets came down the aisle and sat in the front row. One of them launched immediately into a Frenchman joke. A young woman of about 23 arrived with her son, who looked about 4. The boy was wearing a blue snowmobile suit with bright yellow markings and wanted to know if he could talk into the microphone.
"No, dear," the woman said, and they went down behind the men.
The boy immediately began to kick his feet against the bench in front of him, and one of the men glanced back over his shoulder.
"Sean, stop that," she said.
9:45 now. The door was opening and closing with a steady regularity. Men and women of all types and occupations and ages were filling up the hall. There was a drifting hum of conversation, and it was edged with an indefinable sense of anticipation. They weren't here to quiz their duly elected representative. They were waiting for a bona fide star turn in their small community. Johnny knew that most "meet your candidate" and "meet your representative" sessions were attended by a handful of diehards in the nearly empty meeting halls. During the election of 1976, a debate between Maine's Bill Cohen and his challenger, Leighton Cooney, had attracted all of 26 people, press aside. The skull sessions were so much window dressing, a self-testimonial to wave when election time came around again. Most could have been held in a middling-sized closet. But by 10 a.m., every seat in the town hall was taken, and there were 20 or 30 standees at the back. Every time the door opened, Johnny's hands tensed down on the rifle, and he was still not positive he could do it, no matter what the stakes. 5 passed, 10 passed. Johnny began to think Stilson had been held up, or was perhaps not coming at all. And the feeling which moved stealthily through him was one of relief. Then the door opened again, and a hearty voice called, "Hey, how you doing, Jackson N.H.?" A startled, pleased murmur. Someone called ecstatically, "Greg, how are you?"
"Well, I'm feeling perky."
Stilson came right back.
"How the heck are you?"
A spatter of applause quickly swelled to a roar of approval.
"Hey, all right,"
Greg shouted over it. He moved quickly down the aisle, shaking hands toward the podium. Johnny watched him through his loophole. Stilson was wearing a heavy rawhide coat with a sheepskin collar, and today the hard hat had been replaced with a woolen ski cap with a bright red tassel. He paused at the head of the aisle and waved at the three or four press in attendance. Flashbulbs popped, and the applause got its second wind, shaking the rafters. And Johnny Smith suddenly knew it was now or never. The feelings he had had about Greg Stilson at the Trimble rally suddenly swept over him again with a certain and terrible clarity. Inside his aching, tortured head, he seemed to hear a dull wooden sound, two things coming together with terrible force at one single moment. It was perhaps the sound of destiny. It would be too easy to delay, to let Stilson talk and talk. Too easy to let him get away, to sit up here with his head in his hands, waiting as the crowd thinned out, waiting as the custodian returned to dismantle the sound system and sweep up the litter, all the time kidding himself that there would be next week in another town. The time was now, indisputably now, and every human being on earth suddenly had a stake in what happened in this backwater meeting house. That thudding sound in his head, like poles of destiny coming together. Stilson was mounting the steps to the podium. The area behind him was clear. The three men in their open topcoats were lounging against the far wall. Johnny stood up. Everything seemed to happen in slow motion. There were cramps in his legs from sitting so long. His knees popped like dud firecrackers. Time seemed frozen. The applause went on and on, even though heads were turning, necks were craning. Someone screamed through the applause, and still it went on. Someone had screamed because there was a man in the gallery, and the man was holding a rifle. And this was something they had all seen on TV. It was a situation with classic elements that they all recognized. In its own way, it was as American as the wonderful world of Disney, the politician and the man in a high place with the gun. Greg Stilson turned toward him, his thick neck craning, wrinkling into creases. The red puff on the top of his ski cap bobbed. Johnny put the rifle to his shoulder. It seemed to float up there, and he felt the thud as it socketed home next to the joint there. He thought of shooting partridge with his dad as a boy. They had gone deer hunting, but the only time Johnny had ever seen one, he had not been able to pull the trigger. The buck fever had gotten him. It was a secret, as shameful as masturbation, and he had never told anyone. There was another scream. One of the old ladies was clutching her mouth, and Johnny saw there was artificial fruit scattered along the wide brim of her black hat. Faces turned up to him. Big white zeros. Open mouths, small black zeros. The little boy in the snowmobile suit was pointing. His mother was trying to shield him. Stilson was in the gun sight suddenly, and Johnny remembered to flick off the rifle's safety. Across the way, the men in the topcoats were reaching inside their jackets, and Sonny Elliman, his green eyes blazing, was hollering, "Down, Greg, get down!" But Stilson stared up into the gallery, and for the second time their eyes locked together in a perfect sort of understanding. And Stilson only ducked at the same instant Johnny fired. The rifle's roar was loud, filling the place, and the slug took away nearly one whole corner of the podium, peeling it back to the bare, bright wood. Splinters flew. One of them struck the microphone, and there was another monstrous whine of feedback that suddenly ended in a guttural, low-key buzzing. Johnny pumped another cartridge into the chamber and fired again. This time the slug punched a hole through the dusty carpeting of the dais. The crowd had started to move, panicky as cattle. They all drove into the center aisle. The people who had been standing at the rear escaped easily, but then a bottleneck of cursing, screaming men and women formed in the double doorway. There were popping noises from the other side of the hall, and suddenly part of the gallery railing splintered up in front of Johnny's eyes. Something screamed past his ear a second later. Then an invisible finger gave the collar of his shirt a flick. All three of them across the way were holding handguns. And because Johnny was up in the gallery, their field of fire was crystal clear. But Johnny doubted if they would have bothered over much about innocent bystanders anyway. One of the trio of old women grabbed Moochie's arm. She was sobbing, trying to ask something. He flung her away and steadied his gun in both hands. There was a stink of gunpowder in the hall now. It had been about 20 seconds since Johnny had stood up.
"Down! Down, Greg!"
Stilson was still standing at the edge of the dais, crouching slightly, looking up. Johnny brought the rifle down, and for an instant Stilson was dead bang in front sight. Then a pistol slug grooved his neck, knocking him backward, and his own shot went wild into the air. The window across the way dissolved in a tinkling rain of glass. Thin screams drifted up from below. Blood poured down and across his shoulder and chest.
"Oh, you're doing a great job of killing him," he thought hysterically, and pushed back to the railing again.
He levered another cartridge into the breech and threw it to his shoulder again. Now Stilson was on the move. He darted down the steps to floor level and then glanced up at Johnny again. Another bullet whizzed by his temple.
"I'm bleeding like a stuck pig," he thought. "Come on, come on and get this over."
The bottleneck at the entryway broke, and now people began to pour out. A puff of smoke rose from the barrel of one of the pistols across the way. There was a bang, and the invisible finger that had flicked his collar a few seconds ago now drew a line of fire across the side of Johnny's head. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered except taking Stilson. He brought the rifle down again.
"Make this one count."
Stilson moved with good speed for such a big man. The dark-haired young woman Johnny had noticed earlier was about halfway up the center aisle, holding her crying son in her arms, still trying to shield him with her body. And what Stilson did then so dumbfounded Johnny that he almost dropped the rifle altogether. He snatched the boy from his mother's arms, whirled toward the gallery, holding the boy's body in front of him. It was no longer Greg Stilson in the front sight, but a small, squirming figure in
the filter, blue filter, yellow stripes, tiger stripes,
a dark blue snowmobile suit with bright yellow piping. Johnny's mouth dropped open. It was Stilson, all right. The tiger.
But he was behind the filter now. "What does it mean?"
Johnny screamed, but no sound passed his lips. The mother screamed shrilly then. But Johnny had heard it all somewhere before.
"Tommy, give him to me! Tommy, give him to me, you bastard!"
Johnny's head was swelling blackly, expanding like a bladder. Everything was starting to fade. The only brightness left was centered around the notched gun sight. The gun sight now laid directly over the chest of that blue snowmobile suit.
"Do it, oh, for Christ's sake, you have to do it. He'll get away."
And now, perhaps it was only his blurring eyesight that made it seem so, the blue snowmobile suit began to spread, its color washing out to the light robin's egg color of the vision, the dark yellow stretching, striping, until everything began to be lost in it.
"Behind the filter, yes, he's behind the filter. But what does it mean? Does it mean it's safe, or just that he's beyond my reach? What does it..."
Warm fire flashed somewhere below and was gone. Some dim part of Johnny's mind registered it as a flashbulb. Stilson shoved the woman away and back toward the door, eyes squeezed into calculating pirate's slits. He held the squirming boy firmly by the neck and the crotch.
"Can't. Oh, dear God, forgive me. I can't."
Two more bullets struck him then, one high in the chest, driving him back against the wall and bouncing him off it, the second into the left side of his midsection, spinning him around into the gallery railing. He was dimly aware that he had lost the rifle. It struck the gallery floor and discharged point blank into the wall. Then his upper thighs crashed into the balustrade, and he was falling. The town hall turned over twice before his eyes, and then there was a splintering crash as he struck two of the benches, breaking his back and both legs. He opened his mouth to scream, but what came out was a great gush of blood. He lay in the splintered remains of the benches he had struck and thought, "It's over. I bunked out. Blew it." Hands were on him, not gentle. They were turning him over. Elliman, Mucci, and the other guy were there. Elliman was the one who had turned him over. Stilson came, shoving Mucci aside. "Never mind this guy," he said harshly. "Find the son of a bitch that took that picture. Smash his camera." Mucci and the other guy left. Somewhere close by, the woman with the dark hair was crying out,
"Behind a kid! Hiding behind a kid, and I'll tell everybody!"
"Shut her up, Sonny," Stilson said. "Sure," Sonny said, and left Stilson's side. Stilson got down on his knees above Johnny. "Do we know each other, fella? No sense lying. You've had the course."
Johnny whispered, "We knew each other."
"It was that Trimble rally, wasn't it?"
Johnny nodded.
Stilson got up abruptly, and with the last bit of his strength, Johnny reached out and grasped his ankle. It was only for a second. Stilson pulled free easily. But it was long enough.
Everything had changed.
People were drawing near him now, but he saw only feet and legs, no faces. It didn't matter.
Everything had changed.
He began to cry a little. Touching Stilson this time had been like touching a blank. Dead battery. Fallen tree. Empty house. Bare bookshelves. Wine bottles ready for candles. Fading. Going away. The feet and legs around him were becoming misty and indistinct. He heard their voices, the excited gabble of speculation, but not the words. Only the sound of the words, and even that was fading, blurring into a high, sweet humming sound. He looked over his shoulder, and there was the corridor he had emerged from so long ago. He had come out of that corridor and into this bright, placental place. Only then his mother had been alive, and his father had been there calling him by name until he broke through to them. Now it was only time to go back. Now it was right to go back. "I did it. Somehow, I did it. I don't understand how, but I have." He let himself drift toward that corridor with the dark chrome walls, not knowing if there might be something at the far end of it or not, content to let time show him that. The sweet hum of the voices faded. The misty brightness faded. But he was still he, Johnny Smith, intact. "Get into the corridor," he thought. "All right." He thought that if he could get into that corridor, he would be able to walk.